If you have your Bibles today, please turn to John chapter 4. We're going to be looking at John chapter 4. As some of you have probably realized, we are starting a whole new series simply called Keep It Real. We're going to try to keep it real. And we're going to talk about real love and what that means for us in our generation, in our society today. As you're turning to John chapter 4, you could just kind of leave your phone on there or your Bible. And I don't know how many of you have ever been fooled by imitation goods. I don't understand why so many people like imitation goods, but you know, if you do the math, if you don't have the resources, as long as it's good enough, or it looks like that bag, it looks like that shirt, or whatever else, that watch, that it's not a big deal, that you don't mind imitation goods. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but there are a lot of organizations that are getting so good at imitation goods that it is really hard for just an average person to tell the difference between what is real and what is fake. In fact, the Japanese have mastered the business of producing fake plastic food. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Well, just so that we're all on the same page, I wanted to show you this picture. It's amazing now how they have perfected this, that you can actually go in front of these windows of the restaurants and you look at this and it seems as if they are real. It's really incredible how real they look. And my family and I, we had an opportunity to go to Osaka, Japan, recently. And as we were there, we came across some of the most amazing Japanese food. Now, some of you are like, duh, pastor. Japanese food in Japan is good. Just like Korean food in Korea is good. Not in Hong Kong, but good in Korea. And so you're thinking to yourself like, okay, what should we eat? You know, we had a sushi, a sashimi, all this kind of stuff, all the good things that we wanted to eat, and the teppanyaki. And so we were kind of set as we were thinking about all the different food we wanted to eat. I'm going to tell you this, as we were walking down some of these streets where they had these plastic foods, my mouth was literally watering as I was looking at them because it looks so real. Now, those of you who might not know that there's this one little town and this one company, small company, that makes 50% of all the plastic food in Japan. So I'm going to show you this quick video that will kind of give you the reasoning and the philosophy of why they make fake plastic food and why they do it with so much passion. So some of you are thinking, man, people are passionate about all the wrong reasons. But they're so passionate, I started believing them. I'm like, wow, that's really something you want to live for the rest of your life. And so I want you to watch this video and see a little bit of the reasoning behind why they make this. So let's watch this together. I love that phrase. I have a passion for making realistic plastic food. As you think about it, while making plastic food might be very helpful and beneficial for those who are trying to decide on which restaurant and which food to eat, you realize in many other situations, having something that is fake or not real is something that you really don't want. I was just thinking, I said, if you had an option to shop either at the ladies' market or over at Harbor City, and let's just say money was not an issue, somebody decided to bless you with a credit card that there was no limit. I'm wondering how many of us would choose the ladies market. Now, some of you are like, what's wrong with the ladies market? Nothing's wrong with it. If that's your thing, then go ahead and do your thing. But I think I'd rather shop at Harbor City where there's a lot more name brand and better quality things there. Those of you who are just new to Hong Kong, you got to check out the ladies market. And if you don't know where it is, grab somebody and say, take me to the ladies market. Or you could just say, take me to the ladies market in the MTR and someone will lead you. But don't do that. They might lead you somewhere else. So just make sure we're clear on that. Think about it this way. If you had an option of choosing a fake relationship and a real relationship, which one would you choose? Now, of course, you could fake people out on Instagram and Facebook and all the different social media of a relationship that you don't have. But I think all of us can concur that we really do want a relationship that is real. But the sad fact is that right now in our society, we live in a place where we will do anything to make sure that we appear a certain way. Even at the expense of being fake, we rather appear a certain way than being real. I think this is a byproduct of being part of a shame culture that many of us, if you're Asian and you were raised up in an Asian family or you lived in Asia, that is part of who we are. It's a shame, honor culture. You also see it in the Middle East and many other places, even in Africa, the continent of Africa. You'll see the shame culture that's so pervasive that it fuels that facade or even wanting to appear a certain way rather than being real and genuine and authentic. That's why we rather have the appearances of things than to be completely honest and share our hearts. Let me give you some thoughts on this. When we feel weak and we need help, we'd rather not ask because we don't want to not only inconvenience somebody, but also I think we want to appear as if we're strong when we're really not. When some of us feel defeated and maybe just due to various issues of sin or things that have put us in bondage for so many years, instead of being open and vulnerable and say, this is what I'm struggling with and I need help, someone, you need to walk with me through this. Instead of doing that, we decide that it's better to just be religious and spiritual by doing a lot of things. Some of us, we're right now feeling confused and maybe even lost. And instead of appearing as if this is who I am and I need help, so many of us, we rather have this mindset of I have everything put together. I think there's some of us in here who are discouraged and even lonely. But once again, we rather appear in front of other people as if everything's fine. And to that, let me just say this. This is not the life that Jesus intends for us to live and experience. What Jesus wants for us is that he wants things that are authentic, things that will allow his grace and his love to work in our lives. This is why we're starting this whole new series called Keep It Real. Because as we're looking into this series, this is our vision. We want to see people who are living real life, who are living life that will really launch them to live in freedom and in joy, and everything that God has intended for you, you will experience. And one of the best ways, and we're going to keep on pushing this for the next 3-4, maybe just the month and a half that you're with us, is we're going to push a lot for our small group ministry, which is our life group. That we believe that you're going to experience real, genuine life. One of the best ways, especially in our church context, is through our small groups, through our life groups. And that's why for the next 4 weeks, I'm going to take that word, life, and use it as an acronym and cover each one of those letters which represents our life group, which is love, investment, and faith, and enjoyment. And we're going to take it one by one. And these are the components of what we value in our small group ministry. And we're hoping that you'll be able to experience this with us. So let's not settle for anything that is imitation or fake, but rather let's keep it real and genuinely experience the power of the gospel as we participate in our life group ministry. So let me give you the one thing. The one thing is usually what I want you to remember as you leave this place. There are going to be many things I'm going to talk about, but if you could just kind of narrow it down to this one thing, hopefully you will then apply some of these principles into your life. The one thing is simply this. Don't intake what is fake, but be awake to God's love. Don't take in things that are not the real thing, but be awakened in your hearts. Be aware of what God really wants to give, which is His love. So I want to talk about that this morning. There are two things we see in this story in John chapter 4 about being awake to God's love and not settling for what is fake. The first point I want to highlight for us, which is found in verse 1 through 6, is that Jesus entices us with His love. That Jesus entices us with His love. Can we go ahead and start reading from John chapter 4? I'm going to read the first 6 verses. If you don't have a Bible, you could just listen or read on with somebody next to you. Those of you who are part of our church, you've been a member for a couple years, be nice and share. All right? So if you don't see the person next to you have a Bible, go ahead and read it together. This is what the Word of God says. It says this. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. And he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the 6th hour. Let me just pause here as we kind of unpack this idea how Jesus entices us to His love. As soon as this chapter opens up, we notice that Jesus and His disciples, they leave Judea and start heading into Galilee. Now, it's important that you notice verse 4. I hope as we were reading it, you picked up on verse 4. Look at verse 4 again. You will notice it says, He had to pass through Samaria. Let me just make one correction. Not that I'm correcting the Bible, but let me just make one correction in maybe our assumption that we're making in this passage. We need to understand that Jesus did not have to go through Samaria. This is very important for you to understand. He did not have to. In fact, there were other routes to Galilee. This way that he went through was not the only way. More importantly, you have to understand that the more religious you are as a Jewish person, you will choose to go the other way. So let me show you a map so you can kind of understand what we're looking at right here. You will notice from Judea that a lot of times people will go from the east side of the Jordan River. And so they will go around Samaria. But Jesus then decides to go from Judea all the way through Samaria and then heading up to Galilee. Now, why is this important? Because if you look at this map, you have to conclude that the shortest and the fastest route to go from Judea to Galilee is right through the middle, which is through Samaria. But a lot of Jewish people, and more religious you are, you will go around Samaria so you would not touch this land of Samaria. And the question is this, why did Jesus feel as if he had to go through Samaria? I think this is where you need to, it will help to understand a little bit about the history between the Samaritans and as well as the Jewish people. There was great animosity between them. They both hated each other. For those who were Jewish, they did not like the Samaritans because they were a mixed race. They were half Jew and also half Gentile or other ethnicities. And so they married and then they had their babies, and these were the Samaritans. For the Jewish people who prided themselves ethnically as God's chosen people, they did not like people who were ethnically mixed with part of their Jewish ethnicity. So you'll see this time and time again. That's why for the Jewish people, the Samaritans were unclean people. And because a lot of the things that the Jewish people did were ceremonial about being clean or unclean, they just did not interact, and they did not want to interact to defile themselves with the Samaritans. So this is how the Jewish people felt towards the Samaritans. Now, if you were a Samaritan and put yourself in their position, you'll realize why you would hate the Jews. Because as you, as a mixed race, you had no say in being born in this world from a mom or dad who's Jew, but then the other parent is from a different ethnicity. And so here you are, you are hated by these self-righteous people who thought that they were such holy people, and you're the object of scorn from them. So I don't know how you would feel, but I think you will not only feel rejected, but there would probably be a lot of hatred back towards them. And I see this dynamic all over the world. If some of you have been keeping up with the news, you notice that the resurgence of neo-Nazism, as well as white supremacy, supremacy movement, these groups, you will notice that there is a sense of we're the better people just because of race. And that's why what happened in Charlottesville, you will notice that it had such a huge impact in the United States. Some of you could sit there and, well, that's in the United States. The Americans have a lot of problems. But let me just say something I observed. You see this animosity between local Hong Kong and mainland Chinese. And that is something that some of you who are part of our church can testify that you've experienced yourself. Some of you who are local Hong Kong, you're like, oh my God, there's people from mainland China, and you could fill in the blank. And they're ruining our culture. They're ruining our social fabric, how we do things. And my goodness, and now things are worse. I mean, I've heard it all. And I've seen some things. I've heard about some things, but this past year, I've seen some stuff. And I'm just trying to be very blunt and talk about issues that some of us harbor in our hearts. I remember one time I was going through the MTR and I looked because people were like giving a stinky eye, kind of like, eh. And I'm like, what's going on? I look over and I realized this lady was holding a little baby over a garbage can and was peeing in the garbage can in the MTR. And I'm like, Lord have mercy. There was another time I was in the MTR and this lady whipped out this nail clipper and she was just clipping her nails. And then she was being put to all the people there, she was on, and she was just clipping her nails. I'm like, Lord have mercy. So on one hand, it's so easy as I could try to identify and look from the perspective of local Hong Kong, whether because you were here during the time when the British colonized it, bringing a lot of culture and high tea. You always got to stick out that little pinky. You know, very cultured people, and you see people who are from the farm, the villages, and they have no manners, no etiquette, and they come here, and they're taking over your whole society, and you feel as if, what is going on? And that's why you can feel a lot of animosity that the local Hong Kong people have towards mainland Chinese. And I've been on the other side where I've been hanging around with some mainland Chinese people, and you could feel some of the animosity that are directed towards them. When I talk to some of the mainland Chinese people, they'll go, yeah, I try not to speak Chinese unless I have to. I go, well, why not? Because as soon as you speak Chinese, they treat you poorly. I'm like, what's up with that? This is when I want to speak fluent Putonghua and then do some stuff. And I'm just like, you can't treat people like that. So I understand the struggles of and the animosity of those who are from mainland China. Coming to a place and being treated poorly just because of your ethnicity or where you're from, automatically assume that you're this way or that way. And that's why, to those of you who are still checking out churches, I will tell you this. If you're going to be part of our church, you're going to be the most uncomfortable person in our church. Not that it's our goal to make you uncomfortable, but that's what's going to happen. Because we're trying to be a church that has first culture, second culture, third culture people. And you mix those three groups of people together, it ain't going to be pretty. There's going to be a lot of misunderstanding. There's going to be a lot of hurt feelings. There's going to be a lot of miscommunication. But that's what the gospel is about. Can I get a good amen to that? The gospel of Jesus Christ breaks down any walls. And it causes us to love people because we ourselves have experienced the love of God. And so here we see Jesus had a very clear purpose. He chose this route because he wanted to reach out to a people group that was marginalized and despised. That was the mission and the purpose of Jesus. If you remember in Luke chapter 19, verse 10, let me read it for you in the ESV. It says this. This is Jesus speaking. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the laws. Other places he talked about it's not the healthy who needs a doctor, but those who are sick. Jesus was on a clear mission. He was clear on his purpose. And therefore, he was thinking about where in this place of the world are there people who are despised and marginalized and no one wants to reach out to them. And he realized it's in Samaria. That's why it says in verse 4, Jesus had to. He didn't really have to, but it says that he had to. Because that was his mission. Even in the Message translation of Luke chapter 19, it says, "For the Son of Man came to find and restore the lost." That's his heart. Always looking for those who are lost. Always looking to find those who are hurting. And then it says, to restore them. To bring healing. How about us? I'm wondering, are there times where you avoid walking through things in life just because you don't want to deal with all that junk in your heart? Are there times where you avoid people? Are there times when you avoid different issues that keep on coming up when you do things in your life? And in some of us, instead of dealing with it, we go from one church to another church and thinking somehow I'm going to find this perfect church. You won't. Because the problem is within your heart. And so you can go to all the churches in Hong Kong, but you will never run away from your own heart. There are some of us, we avoid family, we avoid different things because it brings so much pain. And no matter where you run to and no matter where you turn to, because there are things that are deep within you, no matter where you go, what you do, you will always have to face this. There are times when Jesus wants to go right through into your heart to deal with those things that some of us have a hard time surrendering. Now, I want you to notice how Jesus entices a person who's so desperately in need of his love. There are a few things that Jesus does in order to speak to this woman. I'm gonna kind of try to systematically highlight this for us and what he does so that it will make us think, how is Jesus enticing me to receive and to be open to his love? The first thing you will notice is that he recommends something better. That's one of the things that he does to entice us, because we always think, oh, this is so good, but then Jesus says there's something better. Let's go ahead and read verse 7 through 15. "A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, 'Give me a drink,' for his disciples have gone away into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, 'How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans.' Jesus asked her, 'If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, "Give me a drink," you would have asked him and he would have given you living water.' The woman said to him, 'Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well, or he gave us the well, and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock.' Jesus said to her, 'Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life.' The woman said to him, 'Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water.'" Wow, the story gets very interesting. We see that the disciples went into town to get food. So now here's Jesus alone as he's resting from this long journey. And as he's sitting there, he sees and notices this woman, and it's not any ordinary woman, it's a Samaritan woman. And so he does something that literally goes against custom and culture. That's why I love Jesus. Jesus, my man. Like, he doesn't just kind of toe the party line. He likes to be different. I like that. So here's Jesus literally going against the customs and the culture of this time. What does he do? he ends up talking to a woman alone in public. That's a no-no. Especially for a rabbi, a teacher, you're not supposed to even talk to a woman, especially in a public place, just because other people might assume things. But he ends up talking to her. Not only a woman, but a Samaritan woman. That the Jewish people, if you know anything, you're going to make yourself unclean by talking or hanging around or even stepping foot on Samaritan soil. That's why in verse 9, as we just read, we notice here the woman is a bit shocked. She's like, whoa, you're a different man. Like, why are you talking to me? And I'm a Samaritan for that matter. And why are you asking me for a drink? So she's freaking out. The only person who's not freaking out is Jesus. I'm sure all the other bystanders are freaking out. This woman is freaking out. But here is Jesus. He's just chill because he had a clear purpose. Now, Jesus gets her attention as he speaks about this living water. It's almost as if he speaks to her curiosity. She's probably wondering, like, who is this guy? Like, who is this guy? I don't think it was because his long hair and kind of like, she's like, wow, who is this guy? It's just like, who is this guy? What is the gift that he's referring to? Because if you knew about the gift of God, then you will never grow thirsty. Like, what is he talking about? What is this gift? And what is this living water? See, Jesus, listen to me carefully. Jesus was metaphorically using the water to speak about how he is the only one that can truly satisfy. Because in the physical world, you will always be thirsty and you always have to come to the well to drink of this water. But he's talking about in the spiritual realm, because all of us are thirsty in our souls, that no water can quench. All of us are thirsty in our hearts, that we long for love, we long for acceptance, we long for belonging, and all these things, you cannot find it in anything else in this world. So he's saying, if you only knew who it is that's offering you this gift of God, this living water where you will never go thirsty again, what he's saying is, I am the only one that can fully satisfy, and everything else pales in comparison. They're imitations, they're fake. This is a problem that I see over and over again with many of us. And I see this in my own heart. We're trying to fill our hearts with things that cannot fully satisfy. It doesn't mean that you cannot enjoy it, because God has given us all things to enjoy. But we make them not just good things, but we make them ultimate things. So friendship, it's a good thing. God has given us relationships, I guess, just given us relationship with people who are considered friends. But if you make them ultimate things, your heart will get broken because they're going to disappoint you. They're not going to meet your expectations. And that's why some of us even now are sitting here and your heart is broken and you are hurt, because instead of seeing it as a good thing, like he's my friend or she's my friend, you make them as if they're your whole life. Parents, I don't know if there's any parents here, but I will say you start realizing this when as soon as you have your child and you try to take care of them. And what do we see over the years? And I'm, you know, realizing now, my goodness, in 4 years, I'm going to be an empty nester. And I don't know how many parents feel about this, but I am rejoicing. I'm not that I hate my children, but I'm like, I am freedom. And I am ready to just, what you know, I don't have to do any of those other stuff. They are on their own. They're growing up. But you know what I've noticed in so many parents? Because they spend so much time and energy and their all their life raising up their kids, that instead of seeing them as stewards of this child that God has given unto them, they make their children their ultimate thing. That's why they find their identity in their kids. So if they get into Harvard, oh, it makes me feel very proud, because whenever my friends tell me, where does your son go to college? Where does your daughter go to college? Oh, he goes to Harvard or Cambridge or Oxford or whatever they get. And how do you feel? You feel good. But when they don't get into those colleges, when they don't have a boyfriend and girlfriend and they're approaching the 3-0, when they don't have that job. Because you were thinking that they're going to be a doctor or investment banker, but they want to do ballet. I don't know. And you're thinking, what? You have made a responsibility of raising a child, stewarding them because they're not yours. It's God's. You made them into ultimate things. That's why your heart is crushed when your son or daughter rebels or they do something against what you want. They have become your idol. Some of you in this room, you are literally on the opposite end. Your parents adore you. They treat you as if you're the king or the queen. And I'm going to tell you right now, it's good because they're teaching you how to be secure, and those things are great. But what has happened is you think you are the center of the universe, and you're not. That's why you constantly struggle with pride. That's why if you don't get your way, you're stubborn, you're selfish. Because you're the pride and joy, and you feel it as if you are the best thing that God ever created. What I'm trying to say is this. Some of us in this room, you are heading down a path where you are making good things into ultimate things. That is what we call idolatry. And that is the thing that oftentimes it will either have to be crushed, completely destroyed, or lost for you to realize, my goodness, the only thing that can satisfy me in this world is Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. It's not a job. It's not a degree. It's not this person that you know. It's not how successful you are, how much money you have in the bank. It's not about how where your flat is or how big it is. But if you have a car or you don't, if you can buy this or you can go to that route, you can enjoy these things. There's nothing wrong with them. God has created. God has given us the ability to enjoy. But if you make good things into ultimate things, you will be disappointed. That's why in the book of Ecclesiastes, what does it say? Here's this person, the king, who experienced everything in life. There was nothing withheld from him. But at the end, he realized that everything is what? Come on, everyone say it. It's meaningless. From a person who had everything, and for them to conclude, everything is meaningless. Chocolate is good, but if all you eat is chocolate, it won't be any good anymore. Some of you girls are like, no, I think it will be very good. It's just amazing how Jesus is recommending something that's better. There's water that's living that you don't even know about. That if you have this, you will never have to come and drink from this well again. That's why she's like, who is this man? What is he talking about? He's slowly enticing her to understand it has to be his love. Another thing you will notice about his method of enticing is not only recommending something that is better, but he reveals her heart. Look at verse 16 through 18 as we continue in the story. It gets more interesting as you read along. It says this, Jesus said to her, go call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. I don't know about you, but if you're this woman, you're like, give me this water. And all of a sudden he goes, go bring your husband. Oh, yeah, I don't have a husband. And then he goes, you had five. Huh? And the one you're living with right now, he's not even your husband. Huh? I mean, you think about it this way. Let's say there's a secret life that you have that no one knows about. And everything's airtight, everything's good. And then all of a sudden, I don't know, you could fill in the blank, roommate, or they go, hey man, I saw you. I see you. No, I saw you at that place. Then the countenance starts changing. And not just that I saw you with that person. I mean, can you imagine the crazy feeling this woman is going through right now? It's like, go call your husband. I don't have a husband, dude. It goes, yeah, because you had five. So that means she was married five times and divorced five times. Let me just kind of say this. I don't care who you are. You could be the most secure person in the whole wide world, but that's something that you're not really proud about. Like, two times, okay. Five times? Are you that bad? You struck out five times. After a while, you're no longer, the people are not the problem. You're the problem. Five times. I'm not trying to make light of this because I know that there are probably some people who are hearing my voice right now, who are in a difficult situation in the family, or maybe you have been divorced and remarried. What I'm trying to say is this. For something that is you're not so proud about, and Jesus all of a sudden exposes and reveals your heart, the question I have for you is, what would you be feeling in that moment? The part that I find interesting is here he is talking about the water. And so she's really enticed. She's excited. She goes, man, I want this thing. It's better than whatever I can have. And all of a sudden he talks about her personal life. Bring your husband. You could tell he's totally in control. It's kind of like, you know, like those remote control. Yes. You know, and just literally just doing everything that Jesus. He is leading her to the corner, to the back alley. And she's just following along, not knowing what Jesus is trying to do. When Jesus realized that she is just thinking about the physical water instead of the spiritual water, he begins to reveal things in her heart that only a prophet or only some supernatural method can have revealed that. That's why she says, whoa, you must be a prophet. How do you know all this? Jesus wanted to expose her heart so that he can show her that even though there's all this ugly stuff, I still love you. Even though there are all the stuff that you've hid for so many years, I die for that. I bled, shed my blood for that. This is why part of being in community, the reason why life group changes a person's life is because you are literally opening your heart to people and mostly to God. When they pray for you, when you share things from the past, things you wrestle through with, as you open your heart, that's when you realize God is doing that ministry within. Listen to what Dietrich Bonhoeffer said. He said in his book, Life Together, he writes, the pious community permits no one to be a sinner. Hence, all have to conceal their sins from themselves and from the community. We are not allowed to be sinners. Many Christians would be unimaginably horrified if a real sinner were suddenly to turn up among the pious. So we remain alone with our sin, trapped in lies and hypocrisy, for we are in fact sinners. End quote. What a powerful thought. That sometimes in church, we create this self-righteous and pious, this holy art thou kind of attitude, that when a person comes in and they're struggling with certain sins in their life, sins of this world, sins of whatever, the flesh, that some of us will be completely shocked to the point where we will no longer open ourselves up to that person. And that person feels isolated, that person feels all alone, and they have no means to directly experience in a tangible way the love of God. And as I share this, some of us are still sitting there thinking to ourselves, oh, that's not me. And I want to say to you, it is you. And it is me. What if someone came into our church or our life group and just shared some horrendous things? I'll be honest with you. Some of us will be taken aback initially, probably. Maybe a little bit horrified. Oh my goodness. I'm wondering what would happen if in our church, whenever someone comes and they have a certain kind of background or certain things that they struggle with, that all of a sudden we will say, we welcome you. Why? Because we ourselves are sinful and we have fallen short. And we've experienced this amazing love of God and this amazing grace of God that we know what it feels like when you are completely wretched, but God loves you and he forgives you. What would it be like? That God loves us too much to leave us just where we are, but he wants to take us to a place where we can openly bear our hearts to say, God, this is the stuff that I wrestle with. This is the stuff that I struggle with. This is the stuff from the past that I cannot let go of. This is the stuff that I've been just kind of, it's put me in bondage. And I'm sharing this with others so that when they hear, instead of being shocked and crazy, like, oh my God, I can't believe that. By the way, a little side comment, whenever someone shares something, please do not say, oh my God, I cannot believe that. Those of you know, I always tell self-righteous people, because they would be like, Pastor, I just can't believe, just like, I can't get along with my roommate. And I go, no, please. What I cannot believe is this. Not that you cannot get along with your roommate, but what I cannot believe is you did not kill your roommate. That's what I cannot believe you did not do. Because self-righteous people always says, I cannot believe. A humble, grace-driven, gospel-centered person will say, no, I could believe it. I'm that bad. I'm that wicked if it was apart from the grace of God. I don't think too many people have that kind of perspective, because all of us in this room, I would say majority of us, we feel like we're not that bad. We're pretty good. I mean, we go to church on Sunday, even in Typhoon 8, we come. On Christ the solid rock I stand. Stormy gale, Typhoon 8, here I am. All of me. No wonder so many people are trapped in lies and hypocrisy. And that's why when people come to church, they think everyone is fake. Because they see you, they see how you act, and they realize, you know what, you act so holy, but you're really not. What would it be like if we can really say, you know what, I'm not that great. I'm struggling with things. Yeah, like this is nothing. Like so many people look at leaders as if they're so holy. I'm going to tell you right now, I know some of these leaders, and some of them know me very well, and they'll tell you, he's not that great. Because pastors are supposed to be very loving, patient. Why are you laughing? Come on now. I'm trying to grow in those areas. I have my fits of tantrums or anger or whatever. I get impatient. Sometimes I don't want to deal with certain issues. I have my own personal struggles. That's why when I see some of you, like on the street, or I see you in a cafe, you have these eyes that like literally you no longer are Asian. Your eyes are like really big and you're like, and I'm like, oh, what's up? And it's almost as if you saw a ghost. And I realized later on as I talk to people, they go, oh, I just wasn't expecting you to come to a cafe as if I don't drink coffee. Or I don't visit restaurants, or I don't know, I don't go shopping or whatever. It's almost as if like I'm like an other. That's why I've seen so many people in the church, not just for the pastor, but even towards leaders in our church. Like the leaders might not meet up to their standard because they're still developing. They're still young. Some people, we're inviting them in and we know that they have a lot of flaws. We know that they're working through things, but no one's perfect. If that was the qualification, none of us would be leading. I wouldn't be standing up here. That doesn't mean that we are exempt from certain standards. No, of course, we have to live. The Bible tells us that not many of you should presume to be teachers because you're going to be judged more harshly. So we understand that. But there are times when some of us think of a leader or a pastor or whoever be way up there to the point where you feel like, oh, Lord, I can't even look at them. Or you kind of, once they make a mistake or they are not as whatever you had in mind, you start judging them. You call them hypocrites. And I'm thinking, you know what? I would love for you to come up here and do what I do every single week. I would love for you to do it. You know, how many times have you walked in someone's shoes and you realize, oh my God, this is so hard. Do you know how many times once these guys are like, I hate my leader. My leader doesn't love me. My leader's so and all this kind of stuff. And all of a sudden they were asked to be leaders and they'll go, oh my God, I did not know. So you know what they do? They call their former leaders. I love you so much. Thank you for loving me. Why? Because they now learn to walk in someone's shoes. Those of you who don't know right now, you don't appreciate your parents because you're just like, they always tell me what to do. They're telling me this. Just wait until you become a child and your first baby comes out and you're looking at this creature or creation of God and you're like, my goodness, like what do I do with this child? And you realize the sleepless nights and when the child is sick and all this stuff and you're thinking, this is what my mom and dad probably had to do. So you call them and go, I love you. And your parents are probably thinking, they're gone crazy, you know, because you never said that to them. Because you are walking in their shoes. In the same way, those of you who have been churched, ever since you were born, you were even worshiping Jesus in your mother's womb, and you were churched all this time. You've never did anything in the world. You didn't do anything bad. You have a hard time walking in other people's shoes who struggle with things, addictions that you don't even know about. You're like, why do they keep on struggling with? Because you haven't walked in their shoes. Until you struggle, something happens. I will never do that. I grew up in the church. I know that Christians are not supposed to do that. And all of a sudden, what does it take? You do it. You fail. You make a mistake. Your self-righteousness gets completely crushed. And then you realize, I am sinful. Just like that person who's never been to church. I'm not any better, but it was only the grace of God. That's why life group is important. That's why we want to encourage you, every single one of you, to participate in a life group. So this is where you experience genuine and real love. Because what God is trying to do right now is He's going to entice you. He's going to entice you as He reveals your heart, the things that you're struggling with. And not only that, but you'll realize when He recommends something better. He's going to tell you, you know what? There's a better life. There's a better way to live. Let me close with the second point as we close out here. The second point is not only does Jesus entice us to His love, but Jesus extends to us His love. Look at verse 19 through 24 as we continue in the story. The woman said to him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet, our father. I'm adding my own laughter here because she's kind of feeling like those nervous laugh. You pick up a little idiosyncrasies of people. They're like, because they're nervous. Or something, they're like, yeah, they have a little twitch because whenever they're nervous, right? So here's this woman go, oh, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Jesus said to a woman. I like it when he goes, woman. He's like telling it like it is. You are a woman. He goes, a woman. Believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is here now when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. Man, we quickly see this woman coming to the realization He is no ordinary man. He knows everything about me. And I think in embarrassment, she changes the topic and brings up an issue about worship. I think this is something we do all the time, don't we? I see myself doing this. Whenever something comes up of things that you don't want to talk about, you try to change the topic. Because we want to avoid things. We don't want to be uncomfortable. We don't want to be made fun of or whatever. We don't want to be vulnerable. So we change the topic. And I look at this and I see the amazing patience of Jesus. He could have been, woman, believe me, you're trying to change the topic. He could have said that. Because he's talking about you used to have five, and now the one that you're living with, he's not even your husband. She's like, okay. And, oh, sir, I perceive you're a prophet, and you know, and this, we're supposed to worship here, but you told Jewish people worship there, and Jesus could have said, woman, believe me, I know what you're doing. But then he's just like, okay, you want to talk about worship? Let's talk about worship. Amazing patience. Because you know what Jesus is about to do? He's about to extend his love that can only satisfy her heart. That's why, listen, there are times when God is so patient with you and he is so patient with me. Because he knows exactly what we need. And we keep on going in all these different directions. And he just lets us. And he's patient. Just like the prodigal father who waits for that son to come back. Because he loves us. And he knows that God is the only one that can satisfy our hearts. He knows this. And that's why he waits. We go through all these detours. We try to distract ourselves. We try to distract other people. We think we could run away from God. We turn to all this other stuff, and our hearts keep on getting broken. Our hearts continue to get hurt. We continue to feel this ache within us and say, why is it that I'm feeling what I'm feeling? And here's God patiently waiting, the prodigal father. And listen to how the story closes out. Verse 25 through 30. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Jesus said to her, listen, this is good. Now he pulls the trigger and he says, I who speak to you am he. He could have said this way in the beginning and said, woman, believe me, I am Jesus. I am the Messiah. Sure, whoa. But he just allowed things because what he's doing is he's enticing her, helping her to see in her own heart that nothing will satisfy. And the living water that you're seeking after is not a physical water, but it's a spiritual water that will refresh your soul, that can only be found when you worship in spirit and truth, when you worship the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And so here at this moment, when she started realizing, making the connections, yeah, I heard about this Messiah who's going to come and rescue us and he's going to save us. And he says, this is the moment. And at this time, he's extending himself in his love. And he says, the person that you're talking to right now, I am he. It's me. Just then, his disciples come back. Let's continue reading in verse 27. Just then, his disciples came back. They marveled that he was talking with the woman, but no one said, what do you seek? Or why are you talking with her? Because he's Jesus. Do whatever you want to do, Jesus. Okay. So then the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? They went out of the town and were coming to him. Jesus finally reveals that he is the Messiah. And it is in this moment, listen to me carefully, when she finally sees her heart for what it is, and she finally sees Jesus for who he is, when there's this instant connection that this is the Messiah. Listen to what Ori and Ram Brahman, what they said in the book Click. It's a really interesting book. They write this. Allowing yourself to be vulnerable helps the other person to trust you. Precisely because you are putting yourself at emotional, psychological, and also physical risk. Other people tend to react by being more open and vulnerable themselves. The fact that both of you are letting down your guard helps to lay the groundwork for a faster, closer, personal connection. When you both make yourself vulnerable from the onset and are candid in revealing who you are and how you think and how you feel, you create an environment that fosters the kind of openness that can lead to an instant connection, a click. You know, when we go, oh, I just click with that person. You heard that flick. Oh, I click with them. Oh, I click with her. This is the reason. Because you are literally opening yourself up, and then that fosters their hearts to open themselves up. And all of a sudden, you have shared experience, and boom, right there, you realize, we click. They went through exactly what I went through. They understand. And so here is this woman whose heart is already wide open because Jesus did surgery on her for the last how many minutes? And then finally he reveals himself to say, I am the Messiah, the one that you heard about, the one that people are longing for. I am he. And it is in that moment she's like, OMG. That was the first OMG. It's like, oh my goodness. Like, what does she do? She leaves her water jar. I mean, at least I would have picked up my water bottle. You know, I would have been like, oh, can I get the water bottle? Sorry. And then I would have gone into town. She literally leaves her water jar behind because she is completely like blown away, like mind blown. And it is then when she's running back into town and she is literally declaring and witnessing, you guys, I think he is the Messiah. I just met the Messiah. The solar eclipse. I just saw the Messiah. Come. And here's all these people. And you read a little bit later in the story, you realize Jesus says, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. The harvest is here. And all those people came to know Jesus because they invited him to stay into town. I'm sure he shared the gospel, the kingdom of God. I'm wondering if this morning, if you've ever really genuinely received God's real love. When was the last time you were able to be vulnerable and connect with people? And not this fake love where it's just kind of, oh, I love you. Okay, you're my roommate or you're in my group. Hi, how you doing? Because you see that in your workplace, don't you? Every morning you walk into your, hey, what's going on? Hey, how was your week? Okay. And you don't want to talk to anyone else. Sometimes it's like that with your roommates, right? You're like, you got stuck with that person. You don't want them as your roommate, but you got stuck with them. So you're like, hey, how you doing? Okay, yeah, I'm going to go out and study. Okay, see ya. When was the last time you connected? I want to, once again, emphasize the place where you will experience the most genuine, real love of God in a tangible way, I believe, this is just my opinion, is in the life group. You can experience it here as we worship, as we hear the word, but to really actually experience it firsthand, it's going to be in life group. I pray that all of us in this room will at least try it once. And then Bo says, try it again. He's telling you to force yourself. But I always just say, try it once. That's it. You don't have to try it twice. Just try it once. But I want to submit to Bo and say, okay, let's try it twice. That's why the one thing, once again, is don't intake what is fake. But be awake to the love of God, to God's love. Can I give us some practical things as we move on from here so we can take the word and apply it? First of all, open your heart to God. Everything you're feeling in your heart, that's God working. He's trying to do surgery. He's trying to show you that nothing's going to satisfy. Right now, the things that you're chasing after, right now, the things that you are involved in, right now, the things that you're trying to do, it is going to lead you to a dead end. It is going to leave you completely dissatisfied, disillusioned, discouraged. Open your heart to God and say, God, you are the living water. You are the bread of life. I turn to you. I need you. Confess that. The second thing is this. Observe what God is doing in your life. See, what God is doing right now is He is trying to bring you to a point where as you're vulnerable before Him and vulnerable before others, that there will be healing in your heart, that God will begin to work in your life. So watch what He's doing. Some of you right now are at a crossroad. That's God trying to do something in your life. Some of you might be at a place where you're like, everything is crashing in. Ask yourself, God, what is it that you're doing? That's why in our church, we had something called the Kairos Circle, which is learning to listen to God's voice and then obey. If you don't know what I'm talking about, talk to somebody and they'll help you to go through it. If you've been in our church, we went through the series even in our church about how to listen to God's voice and to see what it's speaking to us about as we observe things that are going on in our lives. We reflect on it. And then from there, come up with the action plan. What are you going to do? Find accountability and you obey and you follow God. I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to experience a tremendous elevation of your faith because you're listening and obeying, listening and obeying. So watch and observe. What is it that God you're doing? And then help me to obey. Help me to follow. Lastly, offer yourself in community. Do you know that you can actually be a blessing to somebody in small group, in our life group ministry? Some of you come from divorced homes. And all the hurt that you went through of not you feeling not you... You were the cause, maybe, but even though you weren't, you felt, you struggled with that. You blamed yourself because maybe you didn't get into that school or you didn't get that grade. And so your parents fought, or maybe you spent too much money, whatever it is. And you struggled with it. By coming here, you experienced the gospel and He has released you from that. And there's somebody in life group this coming year that will be placed in your life group and they're struggling with their parents' recent divorce. There will be people who will come to our life group who have been sexually molested. And the worst part is by people that you trust, like your uncle, your cousin. And I had to counsel even people who were sexually molested by their parents. And by God's grace, He's helped you work through it. Doesn't mean you're perfect. You're still wrestling through with these insecurities. But God is helping you through it. And you've experienced more freedom than you've ever experienced in your life. And here you are in this life group. And all of a sudden, someone comes in and you quickly notice some of the symptoms. Because that's how you were before you came to know Jesus Christ or before you trusted in Him fully for His grace and forgiveness. And so you reach out to them and you realize as you become vulnerable, they become more vulnerable. And as you share, they find hope because they thought that life was going to end, but they look at you and you still. I pray that we will experience real love as we love one another. Continue to pull us. Continue to move us, stir us towards your love. And through that, Lord, we can extend this love to others around us. By your grace, Lord. Amen. As you know, we sang the song earlier this morning in the beginning, but this has actually been our anthem, our song for the leaders. We just had a leaders summit for the last day and a half. And we were singing this song almost every day, just kind of every session we had, because God gracefully breaks us. He could have killed us. He could have destroyed us. He could have banished us away, but just gracefully just breaks us enough where we realize, Lord, you're all that we need. You're all that we want. Use us for your glory. I surrender all. As we experience His love this year, may this be our heart. I give you myself, Lord. I give up my all. Thank you for gracefully breaking us, turning away from those things that lead us astray, and turning to you. So will you worship with us, and just don't just sing, but make it a prayer as you open your mouth and sing these songs. Let it be prayers, words of prayer that's coming out to God. Let's worship Him together, shall we?